You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, folks, guess what? Fantasy football's back, and DraftKings.com is not messing around, okay? Here's how it works. You could win enormous cash prizes every week. And what I mean by that is you can get free entry into the Millionaire Maker event, which, by the way, means that if you take first place, if you really think you know sports, you will take home $1 million. All you got to do is head to DraftKings.com now, enter promo code Callen, my last name, C-A-L-L-E-N, to play free to become a millionaire, or at least win $1 million. DraftKings.com, bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, for free entry now at DraftKings.com. That is DraftKings.com. Got me? DraftKings.com. Back to the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest, the author of Excellent Sheep, an excellent book, is Professor William Derezowitz, whatever.
It's Derezowitz.
Derezowitz.
Rhymes with Jesuits.
It rhymes with Jesuits. I should have known that. And he's basically, the book is just outstanding. It's the miseducation of the American elite, the way and the way to a meaningful life. Professor, you basically have written about the problems with the elite universities and how you may not be getting an education, or at least the one that you need after all.
And the problem for the society as a whole with an elite that has been miseducated.
Yeah, that's right. That's really important. Because in some ways, students may be getting exactly the education they want, and that is exactly the problem. Mm. I mean, these schools are very good. I mean, they are very good at doing certain things. They're very good at training successful professionals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe there's nothing wrong with that, except that successful professionals are not the only thing we need. And I don't think that college should only be about getting from point A to point B. It shouldn't be about, I go in with an idea of who I want to be, and college is going to just give me the credentials, the training that helps me to get there, that helps me to get to the next stage, to law school or whatever. College should be about, it should be an open-ended process where you have no idea where you're going to be 4 years later, because you're 18 when you start. Mm. These are the first 4 years of young adulthood, first 4 years away from your parents. They're the chance to figure out, to start to figure out, just exactly who you can be and what you do want out of the world. And I don't see, especially our most prestigious universities, the ones that everyone kills themselves to get into, I don't see them doing much of that anymore.
But were they ever doing it? I mean, I know you go through, you know, it's almost like when the good old boys ran the show, when it was a WASPy, right. When it was a WASPy establishment, it was pretty elitist to begin with then. And I know that, at least from what I've read, the idea of being a privileged elite in this country carried with it a responsibility to what you were going to do for society. See the Kennedys, right, as an example.
Right.
As I was reading, I thought, boy, have things really changed that much? Haven't they always been this way?
Well, I think, the simple way to see how they've changed is the professions that people are choosing and the majors that people are choosing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a great quote that I actually read in one of Michio Kaku's books about, you know, that Freeman Dyson, the physicist, said that he could tell when a society was about to, you know, an empire was going to lose its power because its leaders, its elite students, went from creating wealth to managing wealth. And he saw it happen in the British Empire, and that he was seeing it happen now in the United States. And I went to Harvard, so all of my classmates are pretty much either consultants or investment bankers. You know, yes, there are very notable exceptions who go off and, you know, do startups or do whatever, but the majority of people are going into investment banking and consulting.
Yeah, or law, which is, add law and you've got an even larger majority, and it's basically the same idea.
And medicine.
Yeah, look, I don't think that there was a golden age. Mm. Also, the problem of elitism and the problem of the kind of education we're giving the elites are separate problems. I mean, we can talk about both of them, but they're separate problems. Even if these institutions were elitist, it doesn't mean that the education was the same. But, you know, no, I mean, they weren't necessarily that much better 100 years ago. But what is different is that the entire society, at least the entire upper middle class and a lot of other people too, is structured around trying to get kids into these schools. I mean, at least back in the day, you know, if you didn't belong, you didn't even bother to apply. I mean, you know, Harvard's acceptance rate was like 60% as recently as 1950. So we didn't have an entire society that was focused around this. And it was almost better when you knew that you couldn't get in if you didn't have the right last name, because then people had an incentive to invest in public higher education. And that's what we did once upon a time. And we built the largest and the best public education systems in the world. And they were an enormous factor in social mobility throughout the first two-thirds of the 20th century. So along with the increasing sort of stratification at Ivy League schools, restratification, and the sort of increasing focus on just, as you say, managing wealth or becoming a successful professional, has been this kind of this defunding and at least partial collapse of the public higher education system. So people have fewer other options.
I also love, though, so much of what I loved about the book was how you define education, something we've gotten away from, how important a liberal arts education is studying the humanities. You know, education, I think you say, is what is left behind after you've forgotten everything you've learned. Another
right.
quote was, it's like an open wound in a way.
Right.
You send these people out to continue to ask the important questions, to wrestle with the big ideas. That certainly is what education
and was. And crucially, that, you know, education is not about pandering to students. It's about challenging them. And that's one of the big things that has really changed since the 1960s, is that in the 1960s, you know, you held these people to account. They were like, why are you here? Do you really deserve to be here? And now, you know, and having been through the process fairly recently, it's like, you're so amazing. you know, you're...
You talk about that, Professor. I mean, you sort of this entitlement or whatever it might be. You're so smart. What I loved about the book also is these, you know, you're so smart, and you've beaten all these people out. Well, yes, you've beaten the people out who were already in a very select group, the privilege to begin with. I was amazed at the detail. How many? Basically, you've got to be pretty wealthy just to get into these places.
Yeah, it overwhelmingly, I mean, there are exceptions, but overwhelmingly it favors the wealthy because it just takes so much money to get a kid to the point where they can get into one of these schools. You know, you have to sort of force feed them educational resources from the moment they get to nursery school. And yeah, you know, so the smartest kids at the prep school get to go to Ivy League schools, and they feel like they're the smartest because they were smarter than maybe the slacker or the dummy who sat next to them. But, you know, there's like the other 90% of society, of the kids who are like two towns over at the public school. Maybe they were working, you know, in a fast food joint 20 hours a week because their family needed them to, or they needed to save money for college. Mm. You don't know anything about those kids. You don't know anything of what they're capable of, what their life experience has taught them, or just in raw terms, just how smart they might be. And so these kids, I mean, literally, the dean gets up and says, you're the most extraordinary class we've ever had because, you know, the admissions rate is the lowest it's ever been. And basically the implicit message is, you know, you deserve everything that you're going to get. There's, you know, and by the way, maybe you should make the world a better place. I mean, it's this kind of afterthought.
Yeah, by the way. I thought that amazing letter you got from that combat Marine who was talking about being a weed in a garden of flowers. I mean, that guy, I hope that guy's writing because, man, it was so awesome. I mean, you know, his roots took a long time to grow in the rocky soil of reality. And it was all these pretty cool
metaphors.
Just
to give a little more context, this is a combat Marine who was now at Stanford and, unlike his classmates, had spent a bunch of time, you know, serving overseas and now...
Yes.
Was looking at the other Stanford kids and being like, you are clueless.
Which is okay.
I love how you know, how carefully you guys read the book. You seem to have it memorized.
Yes, we do. Listen, man, I mean, one of the things that, you know, Hunter coined this phrase, and I've been thinking about it a long time, some of the best ideas are stuck in books. And so if we're going to have somebody like you on who took the time to write a book that I think is this important, and I, by the way, I think it also took a lot of guts to write a book like this. I mean, you, after all, teach at Yale.
Wait. I have to correct that. You keep calling me professor. You should just call me Bill, partly because that's what I had my students call me anyway. But I haven't been a professor for 6 years.
Okay, good. Yeah. So I'll call you
whether
Bill.
I would still have written this anyway, I don't know. But
yeah, well, I still think, you know, it's great. You were on the inside. And so,
yeah.
So you know, I think it's a very important book. So one of the things that Hunter and I talk about is that these are very important. This is a very important idea, and these are very important issues. And you know, you spent a long time writing this book, obviously. And so it just drives me crazy that people don't give the author the respect to actually really read it and, mm-hmm. and digest what they're trying to say. Because I think we are all remiss when we don't.
Well, and I think, and you know, to go, I mean, one of the, as I mentioned before the interview, like I first, when Amanda sent me, Brian's wife sent me, you know, this book, I was like, oh, wait, that was the guy who delivered my favorite commencement speech of all time.
That's right.
Yeah, was your commencement speech at West Point, or maybe it wasn't a commencement speech, but on solitude and leadership. And right. One of the points that you made in there, which was so excellent, was about the importance of reading books, because the amount of thought that goes into a magazine article is a few hours. The amount of thought that goes into writing a book is years. And so you're getting much more concentrated, distilled thought, much deeper thought reading a book than you will ever get reading magazine articles.
Yeah, right. I mean, they asked. I had written an essay about solitude, and they wanted me to come and talk to the freshmen. They call them plebes, mm-hmm. about the importance of solitude. And I thought, how am I going to connect with these kids? They're sort of different from me. They're different from what I know. So what's important to them? And it didn't take long to figure out that leadership is sort of the holy word there, as it actually is in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. So I tried to talk about why solitude was important to leadership, which really means why is thinking important to leadership? And what does thinking actually mean? Mm. And, you know, this is not a problem that's unique to college students or young people, these days, but the pace of information technology has just made it harder and harder for all of us to be alone with our thoughts and to think carefully. And, you know, a young person wrote to me about one of the essays I'd written and said, you know, I usually don't read anything that's older than a year, but ...
Jeez.
I'm like, yeah, you must be kidding me, right?
Yeah.
You know, a book, I mean, you know, someone's put their life into this. It might be, you know, even though it's going to take more time, it's more worth reading than, you know, 1,000 blog posts.
Especially, yeah, I mean, the thing I get out of books like this is, and you do it so well in the last chapter, is, you know, essentially, you draw a correlation between how elitist our society is becoming, how there is a growing division between rich and poor, and how that is continued and that is fostered and nurtured in the university system, in these elite institutions.
And I think one of the things that's really important, and this is a point that, you know, Thomas Piketty also makes in Capital, is the degree to which the narrative of the meritocracy has been hijacked to justify aristocracy, which I think is a really important point. And I think if you would mind dilating on that for our listeners.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. The phrase I use is hereditary meritocracy, which is intended to be an oxymoron. You know, we had that WASP aristocracy and, you know, through a lot of courage, really, elite institutions like Harvard and Yale started to break into that because they said, look, we can't go on just serving the interests of this one narrow class of people, you know, the rich white Protestant boys. We need to open things up. There are a lot of groups that are rising in society. There's a lot of talent that's kind of being left on the cutting room floor. And they really, I mean, it really was a social revolution that was kind of completed by the mid-60s. But since then, the meritocracy has figured out how to perpetuate itself. And I guess to add Piketty to what I'm saying, you know, he would say, look, it's one thing to say that everyone's going to have the same chance, but when you fire the starting gun, some people are going to be farther ahead than others. And that's really what's happened. And now that perpetuates from generation to generation. There was a cartoon in The New Yorker, a couple of rich guys are talking, and one of them is saying, meritocracy worked very well for my grandfather, it worked very well for my father, and now it's working very well for me.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's the thing is that, you know, it's not even necessarily, you know, that the elites are, you know, doing this maliciously. It's just that, you know, they're not intellectually challenged because there's a complacency that sets in when you're like, oh, it was a competitive process.
Well,
we all applied.
It's more than that. It's more than being intellectually challenged. I mean, one of the things you touch on a lot, and I think it's very important, is that these kids are not figuring out why they're doing this. They're high achievers, but they're not. Their lives are not full of meaning. They're not full of fun, and they're not even aware of why they're doing what they're doing. Right.
It's a hoop jumping exercise. I think that's the crucial phrase that you use in the book.
Right. I think that's right. And I think it hurts them. I mean, ultimately this book started with a sense that there was something going on with my students that was making them unhappy. It wasn't just making me unhappy. And so many kids, and they tend to be the kids that I liked the most, that were the most intellectually alive and just sort of humanly alive. And they didn't know what to do with themselves after college because there was no longer an adult in front of them holding up another hoop. And then a lot of kids, the ones who weren't coming to me, were just happily jumping through the next hoop that actually was being held up by a recruiter from Wall Street or a consulting firm or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think kids are not equipped to question the situation they're in, and they're certainly not, I mean, they are, I would say, shielded from the knowledge that they represent a socioeconomic elite. Because what they're told is that they represent an intellectual elite. And it really freaks people out. I remember freaking me out. When you start to make them realize just how large a role privilege is played in getting them to where they are, because they want to believe, naturally, that it's their own talent and hard work that got them where they are.
Well, and I think the other thing that's important to realize, too, is the degree to which psychological factors play in. Because, you know, one of the things that Harvard talks about, I know this was true with Oxford and Cambridge in England, too, is that it's not just the economic opportunities that are made available to the rich that are not available to the poor, but it's also the belief system, right? I mean, when you go to, you know, a school where, you know, last year there were 10 guys who went to Harvard and you were like, they weren't that smart, then there's the awareness that that's possible for you. When no one from your school has ever gone to, you know, Harvard, or no one in your family has ever gone to college, it starts to seem very mystical, right? And we should, I mean, that's...
Well, there's a feeder system. You talk about, basically, there are 100 high schools but basically feed all these elite institutions.
But there's also, I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, it's economic. It's also psychological. But regardless, I mean, all of the causes that are there, like, you know, I think that as a society, we have to be able to look at what are the numbers of how much, you know, wealth cycling there's going on in this country. And if the numbers aren't as high as they should be, then things need to change.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly agree that they're cultural and psychological factors. And people have talked about that to a certain extent, you know, kids just don't know what might be possible for them. But I also think it's more than that. I mean, to me, the basic problem is that we just have this artificial scarcity of educational resources where everybody feels that they need to send their kids to one of 10 schools or they're going to fall into the gutter. And partly that's crazy and it's just status competition. And partly it has to do with what's happened to public higher ed. You know, I think if there were really good colleges sort of in every community or at least every city, then that sort of dispersal of information you're talking about would be a little easier.
But the other problem as well is that to a certain extent, right, if you're a parent, right, yes, you may appreciate that the system is bad and you may appreciate that the system is bad for society, but, you know, it is the system. And so,
it does bear results, you know, at least your pocketbook's probably going to be thicker, your wallet's going to be thicker. You know, you even talk about it. I mean, you know, if you want to be president of the United States, you probably want to go to Yale or Harvard. I mean, statistics.
Just look at those statistics. And I mean, I thought that was a really important point and illustrates just how bad this is for a democracy. Like in terms of, would you mind breaking that down as well? Like, let's look at the facts of where our presidents are coming from.
Right. Right. If you go back and look at where the major party nominees, presidential nominees have come from, so I also include the losers, From 1948, so right after the war, to 1984, which is the great age of the public higher education, there were 14 people, and only three of them went to Ivy Leagues, went to private colleges. They went to public schools. Some of them didn't even finish college. So it was 3 out of 14. And then since then, it's been 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10 went to a fancy private college, and all of those 8 attended Harvard or Yale at some point, either for college or for graduate school. I mean, that's a remarkable thing.
It's a disgusting thing, I think.
I think it's
a disgusting thing.
Yes, it is a remarkably disgusting thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the same is now true of Supreme Court justices. You can look at sort of heads of corporations and institutions, and they overwhelmingly come from like 12 schools.
And even more narrowly, I mean, you know, we look at the dynasties that are being set up among the presidencies. Like, you know, we've had one Bush, then we had a second Bush in quick succession. We've had one Clinton, and now there's a good chance we'll have another Clinton, you know?
Or another Bush, maybe.
Or another Bush. Yeah, right. Jeb Bush, I mean, you know, is a realistic candidate, and they're grooming Neil P. Bush. There's I can't remember who they at some point during one of the conventions, they were like, yes, and there's Neil P. Bush. You know, he speaks Spanish, he's like,
like got a Latino mother.
Yeah, exactly, or whatever it was.
Bill, let me ask you this question. I'm surprised that Harvard and Yale and all these elite institutions hold as much sway with how much access there is to online education. Do you think that is going to at least mitigate some of their influence as people all over the world have access not only to a world-class education, but also access to classes that are taught at these institutions?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not going to mitigate them for a number of reasons. First of all, as you just said, all of these online courses are coming from these institutions. So while it may mean that you don't have to go there, it builds their brand. And that's a big, you know, these MOOCs, these massive open online courses, they cost, the last I heard, it's like $100,000 per course.
What? Like,
to produce, not to take, obviously.
Right.
So they're a significant investment. And these schools are trying to get ahead of the curve and build their brand. It's the same reason that they're opening up campuses all across the country, all across the world, including in some campuses or programs, including in some very unsavory authoritarian places like China and Singapore. But, you know, so that's as good for them. But also, it's never really going to replace what they offer. I mean, everybody knows, even the biggest MOOC booster, the people who run the MOOCs, will say, you know, in 20 years, there are only going to be 10 institutions of higher education in the world, and, you know, it's going to be the Ivy League and us.
Wow.
So sort of nobody, I don't think that's true, but nobody disputes that the Ivy League is going to stick around because everybody gets that that's a much better, it's a much better education you get online. But also everybody knows what those places are really for, which is for the global elite to come together in one place or to send their kids together in one place where they can network and establish connections. It's basically a global version of the same role these institutions played in the late 19th century when the country became like one economy because of the railroads after the Civil War. And that's when these places became sort of the places we think of now, where elite from around the country went to kind of consolidate themselves as a class. So that's still happening. It's just happening on a global scale.
Well, and I also think, I mean, one really important point that you made with regard to the MOOCs in the book is the fact that, you know, yeah, when Harvard starts giving out degrees based on the fact that you took out a MOOC, like when you can get a Harvard degree from taking a MOOC, then things will have changed. But they're not going to give you a degree for taking a MOOC, right? You're going to get to watch them be, you know, in awe and all of that sort of stuff. But in order to actually get a degree, you're going to have to pay.
Right. That's right.
So it's good advertising for them. It's good brand building. And it, by the way, in the process, ends up destroying the competition. Because as you said, like at a lot of these schools now, these kids are just watching MOOCs.
But, you know, the way I look at it is I have two children and they're very young. But I kind of never really thought of, you know, well, I got to get my kids into Harvard and things. My job as a parent, maybe because this is what my job is anyways, I'm going to teach them to be as innovative as they possibly can. That's the idea. I want them to
But let me ask
to,
you this,
to immerse
Brian.
Themselves in the best that's been thought and said, but then to learn how to think on their own and come up with their own ideas.
But let me ask you this, Brian. Hmm. Would you, like, when you vote, right? And I know that the last year has changed this to a large extent, like having these conversations. But a year ago when you voted, how much would you have bought into the brand of Harvard and Yale when picking a presidential candidate?
Personally, not much, but I understand. I understand.
Or even
you're, and, but yeah. I mean, I would have said went to Harvard, can't be a dumb guy.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the point. Is
and that, that's still around, Professor? Obviously, that prestige has not gone away at all.
If anything, it's going to increase.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other important point as well. Is that part of what you said in the book? Is that by definition, what the system encourages is people who believe that the system is working and, that essentially the current way of operating needs to be perpetuated or done better, not right. people who are willing to step outside and question the system and try and restructure it.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, look, the system's working great for them. Mm-hmm. I also hear from kids who, I'll, talk to kids at Stanford, and, they'll sort of say, the world is basically, going in a good direction. And I'm like, you must be kidding me, right? How could you possibly say that? But in their little bubble of an upper-middle-class world that they've occupied their whole lives, it is going in a good direction. So it's not just that the system is working well for them. They kind of think it's working well for everybody. Mm-hmm. And you sort of give them the statistics about wage stagnation, and they look at you like you're talking ancient Greek. But, it's interesting, this question about the politicians, because now a lot of the sort of bright young conservatives like Ted Cruz, they also have an Ivy League degree, and you would think it would be a liability. And also in general, I can sort of understand why, Wall Street wants to hire from the Ivy League, because they think they're the smartest, whether they are or not. But, politicians, especially in America, it's not like we've demanded that they have huge smarts or great education. So the fact that so many of these people do come from Ivy League type schools makes me wonder really kind of about the insider mechanisms of how you get to be in a position where you can start to run for higher office. Like, what are the actual networks that make it easier for someone who went to Princeton to get into it than someone who went to a, University of Kansas?
And ultimately, that's the other thing too. We're not picking... That's the point, is that the people don't really pick these candidates. To a large extent, what's happening is that they're being pre-screened. And then
picked
we're being
us, yeah.
picked for us, and then yeah. we're as expected to choose from, it's like
they're
which...
two different shades of vanilla,
yeah, exactly.
As you put it.
Which shit
yeah.
sandwich do you want? Do you want a shit sandwich made with elephant manure or donkey manure?
Or they're not, or they're very smart people, but there isn't a lot of variety, right?
Yeah, and they all sort of, underneath their political differences... have a remarkably similar set of assumptions about how the world works. I kind of think that's what we've seen with Clinton and Obama, whom I certainly vastly prefer to the alternatives, but they've both operated within the given system, and they fundamentally seem to accept it.
But that's when I say that these candidates are bad. They're bad because they're not going to fundamentally shake anything up. They've all had to go through campaign finance.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to, Obama said issue number one was tearing down campaign finance. But having gone through that system, he inevitably has to come to terms with it. And therefore, he perpetuates it and increases it.
Yeah.
Well, I like the way you talk about you break Obama down by he gives himself a grade and he's so practical and in middle of the road. We don't have leaders anymore. It's not real leadership, right?
I'm afraid to say that that's true. He doesn't seem to I read that he literally sort of at least his first 2 years in office kept kind of a running score. And he ended up giving himself a 70, which is actually a very good grade if you think about it. Means that he thought he got 70% of what he wanted done. But the notion that he, in his first 2 years, and then he, had this massive electoral disaster, which apparently he didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's, he's clearly very competent in many ways. And we look at him as this breakthrough figure, which, of course, he is in certain ways. But I don't actually think that he's, I don't think there's much that's audacious about him, except, his ambition. I don't think there's much that's groundbreaking about him, except his race.
Right.
And
so we have the miseducation of the American elite. Explain to us what's missing. Do you see a lack of innovation among our young people? Let's just talk a little bit more about what the real problem is. What do you see? What are the visible, tangible things you see in these kids?
Well, what I see in them is exactly what I see in our adult leaders. It's interesting. I think our leadership class has been failing across the board, right? Government, banks, all across the board, universities themselves. It's interesting, they're all failing the same way, and they're all failing exactly the way that I would predict from what the kids, what they looked like, because they went through the same system, right, 30 years ago. So first of all, they're very self-serving. It's, I mean, the nature of meritocracy is, I mean, yes, on the one hand, you know, we reward the best, but it's also about just getting yourself up the ladder, right? That's the point. So it's very self-serving. It's also very self-congratulatory. We were talking before, you know, you're the most extraordinary class ever. Well, if you've heard that about yourself, you really think, I mean, how do these Wall Street types actually come out and say, yes, we're enormous benefactors of society. We're wonderful people. You know, we're the job creators. It's this kind of force-feeding of praise. So they're also self-perpetuating, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, while they're very talented and energetic and bright, definitely the kids that I saw were, they also were terrified of failure because they had gotten to where they were because they had never failed, right? They needed a perfect GPA. So they had never taken a chance on a course that they weren't sure about and wouldn't do so in college. They had never said, you know what, I'm not interested in this material. I'd rather read another book. They'd always done what other people wanted them to do. There was a kind of timidity, and also, and this was the big revelation for me, when I started to hear back from people after my initial essay 6 years ago, there's all this, you know, sort of inner anxiety, inner panic. I mean, in some ways, they're kind of like, I'm not going to say they're hollow men, but there's an emptiness, right? Because if you're always doing the thing that other people expect you to do, to the extent that you don't even realize that that's what you're doing, you kind of never develop that sort of, you know, we're talking about education as a building of the self. You sort of never develop something that can push back against the world, which is, to me, what a self really is. You never develop your own sense of what's important to you or what motivates you or what you feel, you know, gives your life a sense of meaning and purpose.
Is that your
definition
of education?
It's always this kind of it's like a contentless ambition.
That's the thing.
Did you just give us basically your definition of what you consider education to be?
Yeah, I would say so.
And I think this really comes back to your solitude and leadership article. There's a really there's a great book called So Damn Much Money about campaign finance. And one of the points that he makes is that, you know, in the old days, Lincoln had no idea what the people thought. And so what he had to do was search around inside of himself and try and figure out what the right thing to do was and all that sort of stuff. Now, you know, Obama or George W. Bush or any of these people, they just have an instant poll of what the people think. And then they're not really leading. They're just like giving the people what they want. And it's very much the same sort of thing that you're talking about with solitude and leadership, in the sense that, you know, these people, I mean, you know, these institutions in our society in general tells us what to think. We don't have to really think for ourselves, figure out and develop our own values, and then on the basis of those values say, this is the course that I'm taking, and I'm not going to be swayed from that course because I have these core values that I've tested.
Right, that's right. And if you don't do that, you're just echoing back what's around you. And you asked before about these words that we've, these values that we've come to really value, like innovation or creativity. That to me is where they come from. I mean, you can talk, you know, you can have design a course where students, you know, create X or Y or do a project or whatever, and that's all great, sort of the practical aspects of innovation. But where does it really come from as a human being? And I think it comes from the ability to resist thinking the same thoughts as other people. And that's a, I mean, it's an intellectual issue. It's also a moral issue. It's about being able to, you know, I say, because these kids are all told that they're leaders, that they're going to be leaders, right? It's not just West Point. It's like every campus now uses this language. And I say a leader isn't someone who's popular. It's someone who's willing to be unpopular. And willing to be unpopular also means willing to take the consequences of it. I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but on one of the comedy shows, like The Daily Show, a couple of years ago, they did a report about how Australia instituted gun control. And the politicians who did that were basically all voted out of office.
Yeah, but it worked. Yeah.
But it worked, right? It worked. Yeah. That's the point. And I think it was John Oliver actually did the report. And he went to Australia and he said, you know, what's the most important thing for a politician to do? And they all said, you know, do something good for the country. And he came back to the United States and was talking to politicians and asked them the same question. And they said, get yourself reelected.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Isn't that amazing? How has your book been received?
I would say tumultuously.
Good.
Yes, it's very polarizing. There's been a lot of criticism. A lot of it is very defensive. A lot of it is very personal. I've also been hearing from tons and tons and tons of people who are really excited that people are talking about this. A lot of students, a lot of parents, a lot of people who are already working in education trying to create something different, something better.
Well, because it's a form of madness that you're highlighting. This is a form of madness, isn't it? This need to accomplish for accomplishment's sake,
to back it up and
separate yourself. I'm smarter than this guy.
I think that's part of it, but I also think that you use the crucial word there in terms of how people are responding to this, which is personally. And, you know, a lot of what you're talking about in terms of the mindset of what's set up in elite American higher education is also something that has been set up in education at every level, which is that it's personal, right? And, I mean, we've had Carol Dweck on the show before, and a large part of it is that people, you know, think that their successes and their failures are about them, right? It's about, you know, their innate intelligence, as opposed to being about, like, you tried something out, it failed. You don't have to take that personally. You learn from it. And I think, you know, sort of a lot of what underlies all of this is basically how we view our intelligence, and that we think that people who get into Harvard or whatever are these magical creatures, rather than like, oh no, you sat there, you jumped through all the hoops.
And they think that they're magical creatures.
Yeah, which is, even worse.
And I get that. I mean, I was one of those kids. And your whole identity, your whole sense of self-worth really literally becomes dependent on it. To the extent where, you know, if you happen to get a B+, your whole ego structure temporarily crumbles.
Gosh, not mine, bro. A B+ is a big deal for me. Shit. I loved it. Yeah. No. You talk a lot about that, but okay. So you have, I give you a 14-year-old, he's your child. How do you educate your kid in today's world with all these pressures?
Oh, that's the hardest question. I know. I mean, I'm really tough on parents in the book. I know that they have the hardest job, and a lot of them are trying to do the right thing, and it's not easy because you are going to give something up. I mean, you aren't going to be able to, you know, you aren't going to be president or president of a corporation or whatever, or it's going to be a lot harder. So, you know, you're going to give something up, and you have to make hard choices, and you have to make hard choices on behalf of your kids. But I would say, you know, try not to put them in in this kind of crazy pressure cooker situation that exists, you know, in so many schools, in so many places. Just this morning, I was talking to a couple of great kids. They're in college now, went to a fancy private school in Silicon Valley. They said they had great teachers, but that the school itself as a whole was just crazy because it was just, you know, all these crazy rich parents, blah, blah, blah. So I think you got to avoid putting your kid in a situation like that if you possibly can, and still try to get, you know, give them a good education. I mean, I think some schools are doing things differently. I think you need to, even if you are in a situation like that or to the extent that you are, you know, let your kid know that they don't have to do everything, that they shouldn't have to feel the pressure to perform. But at the same time, you know, set standards for them. The things that you do want to do, do to the best of your ability. You know, understandably, parents don't want to raise slackers.
Right.
And I think be in touch with your kids. You know, I think parents think that they're very aware of what's going on with their kids. But one of the big sort of revelations for me was when I read a book by a Northern California psychologist named Madeline Levine. It's called The Price of Privilege, and it's about the sort of level of psychological distress among affluent kids. And the most amazing thing about it was that of all groups of kids in the country, it's rich kids, affluent kids, who feel least connected to their parents, less even than the poorest kids, who supposedly don't even have parents. Because parents, you know, they hover, right? They're helicopter parents. They supervise, they criticize, they have expectations. But that's not the same thing as actually listening, right?
Right.
As actually, you know, communication going in the other direction.
Exactly. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Do you have, I mean, put you on the spot, five colleges you would recommend if we got a kid?
I would never do that. Okay. I would never do that because it's an individual decision.
Right.
Because I think there are a lot more than five good ones. But I would say, look, as an institutional type, I think liberal arts colleges are much likely to be better.
Right.
There are also public liberal arts colleges. They're usually called honors colleges or honors programs. But even within the same institutional type, you know, basically schools differ, like how much of a commitment do they have to teaching? How much of a commitment do they have to the liberal arts? Are they, some of these places are intensely pre-professional, and some of them are you know, encourage more reflection. It's a hard choice. It takes a lot of research, but it's an important one.
Mm. And
but to circle back to the way I answered the question, it's also a very individual one.
And in terms of, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Education is an open wound. Yes, there are these 4 years, but, you know, if we've graduated from college or if we never went to college, you know, what are there books that you would recommend that we should be reading? Are there questions you think we should be asking?
Oh, boy. Again, I always try to duck that question. College students will ask me, what book should I read? It's very individual. I totally agree with you that it's not too late if you didn't go to college or didn't get it in college. It should be a lifelong process. You know, it's like you said a while ago, it's just books. And I would say books that are going to challenge you in some way, books that are hard, books
yeah.
that in some ways make a demand on you. And it could be fiction, it could be nonfiction. It's such an individual thing. I mean, everyone's super busy now. I would say try to cut out some of the stuff that's making you so busy. Maybe start with Facebook, and go back to the things that you've always been curious about and haven't had the chance to pursue.
Do what you
and
like.
Get some books and start reading them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do what you like. Well, yeah. Professor William Derizowitz,
or Bill.
We really do appreciate you coming on and writing this book. I think it's an important book, and I hope it continues to cause problems
tumult.
For people and tumult.
Okay.
I think that's the job of a thinker, and okay. I think you've done your job.
And that's the job of an educator, as you say. The point is not to tell us that we're amazing, but to challenge
right.
our most cherished
right.
assumptions.
Yes, sir. I look right. forward to your next book, man. Keep doing what you're doing because it's...
Thank you very much.
It's awesome. It's awesome. Okay. Thank you.
And it's okay. available on Amazon.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen.
And Audible.
Excellent Sheep is the book. Make sure you get it or you are remiss. Have a good one, sir.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Yet again, Brian Callen, Hunter Motz, exposing the ideas that are stuck in books. Bringing you the truth. Changing your life.
Brian, the way you said exposing the ideas that are, it does sound a little sexual.
I know. Everything I do is sexual, brother. Everything I do is sexual. Do you know what I'm doing now?
Brian, what are you doing?
I'm looking at hot gymnasts.
Oh, my God.
I Googled hot gymnasts, and by the way, I'm looking at the men more than the women. I just really have to come out of the closet. I don't know what I'm doing. I got to stop pretending, America.
Well, you know.
I got to stop pretending. They're so hairless.
But before, what was exciting to you about the male tennis players was the fact that they were so hairy.
This is true. I don't know. I'm a real whore. enough of this. Back to what we were talking about. Yeah, it was great. It's an important book, Excellent Sheep. And I just always come back to trying to get good at anything.
Yeah.
You got to focus on one thing usually, man. You can learn a lot by getting really good at one thing.
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, but be well-rounded. The word for the day is balance. And if
tumult
you want to see where I'm doing stand-up, BrianCallen.com.
Yeah.
I'm about to shoot my next special and I'm cooking. Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to BrianCallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.